Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. For a long time, the American dream went something like this. You move away from the urban center, you buy as much house as possible, and then you go about living the good life, knowing that you can always sell your house for more than you paid for it. Well, then the bubble burst, and the decline in the housing market and all of the ripples that went out in the economy associated with it, this has led a lot of people to question the American dream of home ownership and ask the question, can it be salvaged? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we will try to explore that question as we talk with John Wasik. He's a financial journalist. He's personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News. He's the author of a number of books, including a recent one that we'll be talking about. The title is The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, the subtitle Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. It's published by Bloomberg Press. And take a look at how it is the bubble grew to the point that it was, why it burst, and how, from this point forward, we can think about housing. He has a lot of interesting things to say. If you're interested, by the way, there's a website associated with the book. You can find out more information about the book and about him, and that's cul-de-sac-syndrome.com. And, of course, if you're interested in reading the book, you can head down to the bookstore and look for it. Questions here are welcome. We just ask people who are calling in with their questions and comments to please be brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call. Champaign-Urbana folks, use the number 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. In any case, one or the other number, whichever works for you, feel free to join us. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Wasik, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, thanks, and yourself?
Pretty good.
Good. You know, the notion that home ownership is an important goal for people, that's a pretty old idea here in the United States, and it's one of our most cherished. Do you think, though, that there's something wrong with that? Should everyone be a homeowner?
I don't think so. It's something that's been overstated and oversold for a long time. And really, the most dangerous part of it is that it really compelled people to go into a huge amount of debt to do this. During the boom years, we thought that, well, leverage was good. It was always good because everybody borrowed to get their house. And, you know, when they did, they were assured just by default that they would make money on the back end when they sold their house. It became their nest egg. But it's not the case anymore. We're in a different economic environment. The bubble has burst. And I don't think we can depend on housing values to keep going up indefinitely.
Mm-hmm. When, though, did it get to the point where people started to think about their home not just as a place to live, or maybe even not primarily as a place to live, but also as an investment?
Well, we got really tangled up with that somewhat near the end of the 20th century, where what happened was the social contract frayed. Our 401ks were lackluster. They got creamed in the dot-com crash. And it got creamed in another crash a year ago. The Social Security question raised its ugly head. How are we going to pay for this long term? A lot of people didn't believe in it. Healthcare benefits started to get eroded all over the place. If you had health insurance through your employer, you were paying more. And now in the current state of affairs, we're looking at a long-range sustainable plan. Medicare is going to be running out of money very soon. So the whole idea that we could depend on something, you know, that was solid kind of fell into our homes. And people said, well, what else do I have left to build wealth? Well, they looked at their house and said, this is it, honey. We have our house, and it's always going to be there. And in our memory, home prices have never dropped. So let's invest as much as we can in it.
Yeah, and that's certainly, as you say, what makes the decline in housing values so difficult for so many people is that for a lot of people, that was their prime asset.
It was, and unfortunately, a home, if you chart the long-term price appreciation, say, over 100 years, which is what Robert Shiller at Yale did, and I featured him in my book, is really one of the heroes of this whole debacle, if there can be any. He said, well, look, you know, let's look at this realistically. The real appreciation rate is somewhat around the rate of inflation over that period of time, barely 1%. And when you subtract all the costs in owning a home, the taxes, the maintenance, the money you put in your house just to make it even more livable, you're really not making any money. A house is a fiscal asset. It depreciates over time. It doesn't increase in value. The only thing that goes up is land because it becomes more scarce. So we have this myth that homes will always appreciate. It has really never entirely been true.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that for a long time it seemed to be true. And I think that a lot of people have always had a lot of faith in real estate. And again, there may be a difference between we're talking about the land and the fact that it holds its value and value goes up. There's maybe a difference between that and the structures that we put on it. But having said all that, people had this great faith and belief that the value would always go up. It would never go down. And I think if you go back even several years before the bubble burst, and I think if you went around and you asked lenders, you asked people in real estate, you just asked people on the street, and if they were honest with you, I think that they would say, yes, we know that housing is horribly overvalued, and yet at the same time, everybody seemed to there was this collective sort of ignorance. We all pretended not to notice.
Well, there was a collective mania going on where people were really sucked into the whole vortex of thinking, my God, they're going up double digits, and if I don't get in now, I'll be a real sucker. And so people just plunged into this. They leveraged to the hilt. And you know, the entire real estate construction and banking industries were saying, look, leverage is good. It's your friend. You can buy as much house as you possibly can. And why not do it now? Because the tax laws favor this. You can write off the interest. You can write off some of the property taxes. You know, you can even write off mortgage interest on a second loan, on a home equity loan. So why not?
Yeah.
So people said, you know, the government's subsidizing this. The government wants us to do this. Home ownership is a good thing. Even George Bush said, you know, this is the great American dream. We should encourage this. That's exactly what people did.
Well, you point to something there that, and I know that one of the things that you recommend, and it might be one of the most controversial things that you talk about. I think that a lot of your ideas that a lot of people would sign on to, but one that I'm sure a lot of people will question because it's one of the most, I'm sure one of the most popular, most frequently taken tax deductions for middle-class people. You suggest that the deduction for the interest on the mortgage ought to be eliminated.
Well, it's always troublesome because what happens is that because people see this built-in subsidy, they think, oh, my God, I'm getting a break on the price of the home, and it distorts the price of the home. So people think, well, I should be buying more house. So they get into more debt. So it creates this little incentive that is artificial. It's not really the price of the home. It's what the government is giving you a break on. Therefore, you're going to spend more for that home, and you're going to get into more trouble. Obviously, most people, I think, are responsible about this, and they understand how it works, and they don't abuse it. But in most times, it probably inflates real estate prices to the point where the correction is much rougher on the downside.
Yeah. Just one other thing quick as a basic kind of idea, then we'll go to a caller here. You're also making the argument that the housing bubble did, in addition to creating the kind of problems that we've talked about, what it did was it helped to fuel a non-sustainable pattern of development in terms of what we build, how we build it, where we live, and that those are important. We need to look at the consequences there too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a whole ecological question to this, and I did a very sketchy sort of analysis on, you know, where most of the overdevelopment occurred in deserts. You know, you look at the Central Valley of California, look at Las Vegas, Phoenix, places like that. There is no water. It makes no sense to build there. There's no infrastructure. There's no way of getting water to where you need it easily without spending billions of dollars in zapping the overtaxed aquifers in Colorado River. So, you know, it didn't make sense for a lot of places. And, in fact, I took another look at it and said, wait a minute, it just isn't the deserts that are having the problems. It's other areas. Atlanta, you know, and about a third of the United States has definite water problems because they've tapped out of groundwater. Up in Chicago, of course, we're fortunate because we have Lake Michigan, largest source of inland, you know, water, fresh water, you know, almost in the United States. So, you know, we're kind of blessed and cursed because we think, oh, this is an infinite source of fresh water. But water is a finite resource, and we really don't think about that when we build homes.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Wasik. He's a personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News. He's the author of a number of books, and he's won several awards for his writing, including the 2008 Lissagore and several from the National Press Club. He's appeared on national media, NBC, NPR, PBS. He makes his home in Chicago, and we're talking about what you will find in his recent book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. That's the subtitle. It's published by Bloomberg Press. And questions are welcome. We have one here ready to go. Others certainly can call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And first up is someone in Champaign, line one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I appreciate the guest's comments. My concern is that there is a real perception that the people who are buying single-family homes were the reason that this bubble exploded, and I think that that's a lie. I really believe that in my own family's experience, my sister was encouraged to buy a home. She was given clearly predatory banking arrangements. She was led into this with a rate that was at the very end of her sustainable income, and then it was built in with a two-year escalation clause, two-year adjustment. And when it adjusted, it was clearly outside of her ability to pay. And that, I think, is the thing that nobody wants to look at in this, quote, crisis, is that the banking industry completely orchestrated this whole collapse, sucked the money out, and then now they're getting bailed out. And I think the idea that we blame this on the cult of owning homes is much different than people who either, A, were sucked in as my sister was, or the whole flip this house, I'm going to make, you know, 10 grand on buying and selling this house like you know, people buy and sell marbles on the playground. This is not the same thing. We had a cult of, I'm going to make a fast buck, and I'm going to let the banks and the government subsidize this. And the result was disaster. So I'll hang up and listen to the comments offline.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. What do you think, Mr. Wasik?
Well, sir, I totally agree with you. There are so many different dimensions to this debacle, and I pretty much get into them in the book. You're right. It just wasn't the single-family homeowner who caused this. There was the breakdown of the securitization of these loans, the fact that, you know, a mortgage broker or bank could sell the loans and have no legal responsibility for how they qualified or underwrote the loans. Clearly, there was some very profound and pernicious patterns of abuse in terms of selling mortgages and second mortgages. And, you know, there's tens of thousands, if not maybe hundreds of thousands of cases out there where there was incredible abuse of just these mortgage companies coming into neighborhoods, many minority neighborhoods, and this has been documented, and saying, you know, we'll sign you up, we don't care, you know, and then basically got a commission up front, they sold the loan. So there was a huge amount of abuse, and it was really fomented by the fact that Wall Street got its hands on this whole process and said, look, everybody in the chain is going to make money. We don't care about these buyers of these homes because, you know, we're going to securitize them. We're going to package them in bundles. The ratings agencies are going to rate them AAA, and we'll sell them as if they're the safest bonds on the planet. Well, that wasn't true. There was a lot of deception. Wall Street, the banks, the brokers, I mean, everybody had a piece of this. So I try not to oversimplify the extent of this, but there were many, many layers of this onion.
Mm. Well, I don't in asking this question, I hope people will not be angry with me. I truly don't intend here to get into blaming the victim. However, you know, when people go in to apply for a loan, they go in there, they sit down with the loan officer, they give them their income, they give them their debts, and they crunch the numbers, and then that person will turn around and say, all right, this is what you can afford. Well, is it not up to that person to look at that number and to be realistic and say, well, maybe you think that's what I can afford, but I don't, and I'm not going to borrow the max available. I'm going to borrow a little bit less. I mean, how do lenders decide how much they think people can afford?
Well, there used to be a rigid formula that pretty much said, you know, you should be spending about a third or less of your income on housing costs. But in many parts of the country, you know, especially on the coast, you're going to be spending more than half of your income to afford a decent single-family home. You know, in the underwriting standards clearly got bent and abused and thrown out the door, mostly because of securitization. The people writing the loans didn't really care if they qualified because they got compensated whether they were good risks or not, and they assumed that Wall Street would take the risks and somehow mitigate them somehow, and they didn't really care, to tell you the truth. So they passed along the buck, so to speak, and that's what really happened.
Next up here, we'll talk to somebody in Belgium, the community that's over in our neighboring county, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. The one thing you haven't really addressed here with home ownership is the fact that it doesn't matter whether the price goes up or not. You are buying a place for yourself to live. And instead of giving an enormous amount of interest to a bank all the time, you, as you buy this house and you pay it off and you become a homeowner, you now have something that is an asset to put in your pocket. Whether it appreciated or not, it's still an asset. And it's better than just giving a rent check to some landlord.
Well, do you think, is it, Mr. Wasik?
Well, it is, and it isn't. I think that people have been really misled in terms of what they could expect from appreciation in a home. Yes, I've always thought it's better to own than rent, and certainly I've been, you know, down that path myself. But, you know, you have to consider you never really own it because of property taxes. If you don't pay your taxes, then, you know, the county's going to own your property and sell it for a tax lien. So there's a little bit of an overemphasis on buying versus renting, and not everybody can afford to do so.
Can I take an exception with you there, sir?
Sure.
The property tax really isn't buying the house. What you're doing is you're paying for the right to have roads come to you, schools, all the amenities of civilization. It's not really buying the house. It's paying for all the things that get you to the house.
Absolutely, and I think property taxes are a good thing for what they pay for, and we need these things. We need these amenities. We need infrastructure. But, you know, if you are constantly thinking that, you know, you have to have this asset, and perhaps you can't afford it, then it can lead you down the wrong path sometimes. But for a lot of people, it's a great thing.
Thank you very much.
Well, I do think they'll get the idea that you've got some issues with property tax to the extent that, you know, property tax is a way that local government funds an awful lot of its activities. Did the reliance on property tax and the interest in governments to local governments to have funds to make things go, like schools, did that contribute to the inflation of housing values?
I think so, because what happened was that when a municipality is talking to a developer, the developer says, you know, well, I'm either going to do multifamily units, high-density type of thing, or I'm going to do these very upscale McMansions. What do you think the community is going to say? They're going to say, well, let's go for the McMansions. And the prime reason is that they'll get much more in terms of property tax from the big houses, which means better schools, which means they can say, you know, we have a great school district. Look at all the money coming into it. So there's this built-in incentive to say, let's build low density, let's build these very resource-dependent type of communities, and that just inflates home values even more. And, you know, what happens when these type of communities empty out or there's foreclosures, as is happening right now? School districts and all the other taxing bodies get hurt because there's this direct link. I'm suggesting in the book perhaps another way of looking at this is to de-link property taxes from local services, maybe diversify the source of income that comes into the tax coffers, say you have more from the state, more from sin taxes, more from excise taxes, so that you don't have this pattern of communities constantly saying, we're going to have the biggest homes out there in school districts. They've got to be great because all the money's coming in. There needs to be more money going elsewhere in terms of inner city schools, in terms of other services. So diversifying the tax base has to start with the property tax.
Let's talk with someone in Lovington. They're up next, line one. Hello.
Good morning. It always seems to me like when we're having these discussions and thinking about these economic things, we act like people are rational on these things. And I think one of the problems with this whole thing was that a lot of people, you know, David was talking about, you know, some individual going in and saying, well, wait a second, maybe, you know, this looks good to you, but it doesn't look good to me. A lot of people, I think, really just, you know, their main priority for whatever reason isn't balancing their checkbook, and as long as they can get along and get led to a bigger house, that sounds good to them. And I don't know, I just wonder sometimes what happened to, like, some of the usury laws, and I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's everybody should have to be ultimately concerned about, you know, how much they make. And you know, at some point, I think the government should have stepped in and said, you know, these people are getting used and all this stuff's ratcheting up with, and it's all going to end someday, which it has now.
Well, during the last couple of years, there was this attitude that the market knew everything that people needed to know, that, you know, market rules were okay, that it was okay to deregulate banking products, to let interest rates float wherever they're going to float, to expose people to bond market risk through mortgages. Everything was okay because, you know, it was the market economy. Things would get sorted out. That was the prevailing wisdom, if you will. But it proved to be destructive because you have to have some limits on what the market does because it goes both ways and it swings down. It hurts everybody except people who know how to manipulate it. And mm-hmm. Wall Street had a leg up on this, and they certainly knew what they were doing and how they were selling these products of bundled mortgages. Mm-hmm. But it brought the whole system down and caused one of the greatest financial catastrophes since the Great Depression.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess when it's a bigger question probably, but, you know, they always talk about the consumer. And ever since I ever heard them talking about the consumer and our market's consumer-driven, it's always sounded to me like the consumer's kind of like, and there goes the herd, you know, and we need to pick out what we can, the people that you know, Wall Street and such, you know, has always been preying on that kind of thing. But I'll hang up and listen.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We're about midway through this hour of Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and the guest this morning is John Wasik. He's a personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News. He's the author of a number of books, including the book that we're talking about this morning. It's titled The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. It's published by Bloomberg Press. There's a website for the book. You can find out more about the book and about John. It's thecul-de-sac-syndrome.com. And questions are welcome. We have a couple of other people here we'll get to. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next is someone in Normal, line two. Hello. Yeah.
Good day. Mm-hmm. Excellent program. I had a short comment. There was the one caller he talked about, you know, I dabble in accounting a little bit in the term of, like, asset. the way people should not really mince words. I mean, I believe in the benefits of owning a home, but there's no way you could sit there and say it's an asset. It's a liability. A true asset would provide a revenue stream, such as a profitable mine, productive farmland, or a factory that you own. It will provide you revenue streams. A home will never provide revenue. You always have to keep investing in it, but it may be worthwhile, you know? Hello?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, it's really quiet. My phone line sometimes disconnects.
No, we got you.
Too, and then what the other previous guy just said right now, people, when they talk about us being consumers, I hate that, you know? It's like we're so much more than consumers. We're citizens. We're human beings with inalienable rights. And some folks out there actually say that we're children of God, which means that we're these divine entities which have some sort of a supernatural aspect to it. And when you call us a consumer, you throw all that out the window. I'm just a walking checkbook that buys stuff. But, hey, thank you for the program.
Well,
you guys are excellent.
Well, you want to comment on that any way you like?
Sure. There's two ways of looking at this. One is that there's been two mega philosophies that have been competing in this country for years. The first one is that people are entirely rational. They make the best decisions for themselves. The market's, you know, correct and do what they need to do. The other one is that people don't always make the best decisions, that they tend to be irrational. They get caught up in manias. They tend to look at short-term results. They tend to think that, you know, they know what's best based on very limited information, and they have a very chauvinistic attitude towards what's right and wrong in terms of finance, and they often get it wrong. That's, you know, I subscribe to both theories, but more or less I believe that, you know, people have been myopic in terms of seeing economic reality, and the very fact that we're constantly bombarded with this propaganda and treated like consumers, it just exacerbates it. We're not treated as thinking individuals. We're not given all the information. Some of the people were signed up to these most egregious mortgages. We're not given the whole picture, and that was a disclosure problem. They weren't told, well, this will happen if interest rates go up by 1%, or this would happen if your taxes go up, or this would happen if somehow you lose your job, you go into foreclosure. Was that spelled out to everybody? No. You get a stack of papers, you get a couple minutes to sign everything, and very rarely were these things reviewed. So people were treated like cattle in many cases.
Well, in terms of either the way lenders are regulated or what they're expected to tell people, since we've gone through now what we've gone through, has any of that changed?
Well, there's a whole raft of laws that have really come out of this, some that are extremely helpful. There's credit card reform, which wasn't related to the mortgage crisis, but they really have not tackled the whole idea of reforming mortgage brokers, disclosures on mortgage documents. I have yet to see that come through, and I think that's essential if we're to avoid the next catastrophe. Hmm.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for the program. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share an observation that I was shopping for a mortgage about 6 years ago and settled on three institutions to compare and, you know, compare with. And one of the local banks, the loan officer that I worked with, was really trying to sell me an adjustable rate mortgage. And this person would, you know, tell me about how much more house I could get, and, oh, well, in a couple of years we can just redo the financing, and just made it sound so simple. And but I just felt that I was being sold something that I really didn't want, and went with one of the other institutions. But I was just wondering, you know, just as an example of maybe how, I was being sold a bill of goods, and I'll hang up and listen. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, there was always a teaser there. You know, you would get the low rate now, and then your home would appreciate. You could take money out of it, and you could refinance at maybe a lower rate because the short-term thinking was, oh, rates just keep dropping, and that makes financing even more attractive, and it makes leverage even more accessible. So So that's what the banks were selling. Even Alan Greenspan, at the height of the boom, said, you know, you'd practically be a fool not to get an adjustable rate loan because the rates were so low. And what the whole Wall Street mentality is that, you know, they focus on what's going on now because they know people really get sucked into it. We're kind of hardwired to think, well, it's sunny today, it's going to be sunny tomorrow. You know, most rational people, you know, when they stop to think about it, think, well, what happens if rates go up or something happens in the bond market or the dollar drops? They don't give it a whole lot of thought. And when you're in there talking to the banker, you get the same old mantra. You know, the real estate agents, the people selling the houses, they're saying the same thing. Get as much leverage as you possibly can. The rates are low. They'll never be lower. You'll be a sucker not to do it. And people went for it.
Let me ask you about something different that also you address in the book. I think there are some people who would argue that for some time now, we have been building houses, not the houses maybe we should, the kind of houses we need in this respect. That is, we have had, in most construction, we have had very little regard for how much energy it would take to build and to operate the home. We just almost not thought about it at all. And certainly there are a lot of people who during that time were arguing that was the wrong kind of approach. But is there some way that the kind of ideas that we were talking about, particularly the idea that the value of the home would always increase, and maybe, again, that pushed people to buy the biggest house that they thought that they could afford, also contributes to a kind of building that's just simply not sustainable in an environmental, ecological sense?
Well, I have to give you a little background before I really answer the question. The original book that I wanted to write was an economic argument for green building. I've always thought it was a great idea, but it makes sense because you have less resources in a resource-challenged world, produces fewer greenhouse gases. Buildings and homes produce like 30-40% of greenhouse gases in this country. It's a huge amount. And this is where we need to start to be in the game in this century. And I had to throw out about 140 pages of the book when the whole housing market blew up, and I had to explain that. And so the first half of the book was absolutely dismal about all the mistakes we made and the exploitation and the things that went wrong and the market almost collapsing and the depression coming on that people predicted might have happened. The second half, I really said, look, why does green building make sense even after the housing crisis? And really, I came to the same conclusion. Well, you know, the bottom line for a lot of people is that homes have become increasingly unaffordable. You know, if you're constantly spending more and more money on owning a home, on property taxes, on transportation getting to and from that home, you have very little money for anything else. So, you know, the American dream is still intact. People will do anything to get into that house. They will over-leverage. They will, you know, have their spouse work an extra job. I mean, it's just straining people like unbelievable amounts of time that are being lost. It's hurting their health. It's hurting their well-being. It's hurting their communities. It's hurting democracy. So what's the alternative to that? Well, you have to bring down the cost of building the house. I always tell people, look, the way we build houses with 2x4s and stick-built building is the best 19th century technology we have. We're still building the same methods, using the same methods that were invented in 1830. We can build houses on assembly lines in modular units. They don't have to be ugly. They can be up-to-date. They can be energy efficient. They can produce their own energy. This is the 21st century. The metaphor that I love for this is the fact that, well, look at your cell phone. What did your cell phone not do 5 years ago that it can do today? Every year, every 6 months, there's more features on your cell phone. You get GPS, pictures, video, everything. Why doesn't your house keep up with technology? The house is just about the same except for the stuff you put in it. So why don't we upgrade building technology science and say, look, a house should be producing energy. It should be costing less over time to maintain rather than more. And just the very fact that we love computers, we love flat-screen TVs, things like that, you know, is increasing the amount of electricity we need. We need to build more power plants just for this stuff. So why don't we make the overall energy load of a house lower, make it more efficient, make them warmer? I mean, Illinois winters are horrible, and we should be able to make houses, you know, conserve that heat, conserve all sorts of energy a lot better. A lot of this stuff is already here. It's not rocket science.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people would say that the reason we're not doing that is not because we don't know how, because clearly we know how. Part of it might have something to do with, education of consumers, so that when people say they're looking for a home, that's what they're looking for. I think, though, also when you look at some of these cutting-edge technologies, they're not cheap, and I think that some people might look at the construction cost per square foot, look at the old way, look at the new way, and they might go with the old way because it's cheaper.
Well, absolutely. I mean, economics rules the day, and we really can't ignore that. But if we incorporate these features into every home, make energy-saving features a part of the home and make them as ubiquitous as a microwave or a stove or any other appliance, so that it becomes invisible. We should have cybernetically wired homes that monitor energy use and respond accordingly. If these features are built in every home, we won't be worried about the cost, because then there would be mass produced and the cost comes down over time. In fact, I looked at some green custom homes in researching the book all across the country. And yes, they were really expensive. And these people were glad to spend the money on the features, and they spent a load of money on building these homes. And it shouldn't be that way, though. These kind of homes should be mass-produced with all these features built in them. The same way you know, when you get a home, you get it central air. Nobody questions it anymore. Mm-hmm. 30, 40 years ago, it would have been a real luxury, but now everybody has it. So why can't we have other energy features? Why did it take so long?
How much of that do you think has to do with getting used to people, getting people used to the idea of living in a smaller home and scaling down what is the average square feet in the average American home?
Well, the one thing we need to look at is the use of space. A lot of space is wasted. I looked at a lot of designs where it's like what I called ego space, where you have these huge atriums that you have to heat. It's empty air. It's not even being used. It's not efficiently used. The one green modular home I saw that was built in Chicago was not a big house. It was like, just over 2,000 square feet. And yet it seemed very spacious the way it was designed. People don't need as much room, and they don't need to waste as much room. There are better designs. They're not really complicated. Frank Lloyd Wright was a master of using space, and I mentioned him in the book, and there's other ways of doing it rather than just creating more ego space.
I'm sure that there are things that can be done to retrofit existing housing, but I also wonder whether one might have to look at some of the houses that were being built, say, within the last, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years, that you would have to say, well, really, you can't do much with that house, and we have to be honest and say, what we're really going to have to do is tear that house down, because it's just not sustainable the way that it is.
Not necessarily. I mean, a 100-year-old house, yeah, you got some real issues there, because it was never really created with the idea that energy would ever be expensive. A couple of years ago, my wife and I bought a 1948 ranch house, and there was literally newspaper in the walls because energy was so cheap back then. But now it's, you're looking at some of these houses cost hundreds of dollars a month to heat and in air condition. And there's no reason why they can't have more and better insulation inside of them. And then that's not difficult to do. I looked at some of the incentives in the last round of legislation, and there are incentives for better doors, better windows, wood heating, geothermal. I mean, across the board, you can get a tax break on putting in any one of these things, from whole house fans down to, the most sophisticated energy-producing system. So that's what we need to do. We need to create more incentives, put them into building codes, make a national model building code so that green building is the standard everywhere, and this can be done.
And that's, I think you point out that, in fact, there are these model building codes, things that are models because of their green approach, because of the way that they use energy. The codes are there. Would it I suppose the question is, well, how do you get people to build according to those codes?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of problems because most building codes are done on a local, regional, or state level, and really that's where the change needs to occur. But if you have a national model building code that say comes out of the Department of Energy, and you create an education campaign to educate, you know, local code people that, you know, this is the way to go, this is how we can change it, and this is how we can really help the populace of homeowners, is to say, look, a better building code means lower home ownership expenses. That means more people can afford to own a home and keep it. The societal benefits go across the board.
We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, John Wasik. He's a financial journalist. He writes personal finance column for Bloomberg News. He's authored a number of books, has appeared on NBC, NPR, PBS. He makes his home in the Chicago area. And we're talking about here some of the ideas that you will find in his book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome: Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. That is the subtitle. It's published by Bloomberg Press, out in the bookstores now. There's also a website, cul-de-sac-syndrome.com, you can take a look at. And questions, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Are there some places, do you think, if you look around the country, some places where you would say that they're doing particularly well, or at least they're making some serious progress on the kind of things that you recommend?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of sustainable development going on all over the country, and just about every state is experimenting with it in some way. There's a lot of incentives in the West. Colorado's kind of a leader. Arizona has a few communities that are, you know, solar communities. California, of course, has a million solar roofs program. Oregon is very much ahead of the curve. Surprisingly, places like New Jersey had some pretty good incentives for alternative energy. And there's you know, every state has its own program in addition to the 30% income tax credit you can get on most energy sort of credits on your tax form. So it is happening, and I think the big door is going to open very soon, where climate change legislation, when it gets passed, will profoundly change the way we look at energy. There will be all sorts of additional incentives to do green building and sustainable development because it's in our best interest to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll get next to a caller in Indiana. This is DeMont, Indiana, line number 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, first time I've ever been on the radio, so you'll have to excuse me. My thing is, I went through all this with my home. I changed all the lighting and put all these fuel-efficient bulbs in and everything, and it actually helped reduce my consumption cost for wattage. Well, the thing is, after about a year or two of my consumption cost going way down, now my cooperative raises the price of electricity, so now I'm paying the same price as I did 2 years ago. So where's the bargain there? We're getting more fuel efficient, and we're trying to get more fuel efficient, but yet the cooperatives and electric companies keep on raising their rates. So it's a lose-lose situation for me. What
well,
do you
it,
think?
It shouldn't be down the road, and this is one of the conundrums where, you know, the cost of electricity will rise, because demand is increasing. People have more appliances, they have more electronic stuff, just a whole bunch of new doodads are chewing up more electricity. And at the same time, they're not really building any new power plants. So you can either attack this one of two ways. You either say, you know, we either got to ramp up renewable sources like crazy and start a huge building program in everything, you know, solar, geothermal, wind, you know, across the board, plus there should be institutional energy efficiency campaigns where you have, you know, a guy instead of the meter reader, he's an energy auditor. He comes in your home and is like, oh, you know that, you know, computer over there is always sucking electricity, and here's a device that can help you, you know, ratchet down the power usage. Or, you know, there's all sorts of ways to do this, hundreds of ways, in fact. But the utilities should be doing this, and we should change the business model for the utilities. They should be rewarded based for the amount of energy they save, because if they're saving energy, that means we don't have to build another coal-fired plant, less greenhouse gas emissions, less mercury in the air and water, less, you know, asthma incidents. You know,
you're absolutely right. We should be rewarded for lowering our consumptions of electricity, and 80% of our power comes from coal-fired plants.
That's right, and it's not a good thing, and we shouldn't be building more of these things unless we can clean them up in every aspect of the way they pollute. But in the meantime, we have to tell our elected officials, look, I should be rewarded for saving energy. The utility should be rewarded for helping me to save energy, and they shouldn't be compensated in paying dividends based on the amount of energy that they sell.
Right, I know. I'm paying 17 cents per kilowatt hour, and it was from 14.3 the year before. They keep on raising the rates, and I use less, and I still have to pay more. I should be rewarded for the less. I use half as what I used to use 2 years ago, half the amount of electric.
Well, that's why alternative energy makes so much sense. If solar panels, wind power units come down in cost, and we get more tax incentives to put them up, then we can do net metering, meaning that, you know, we start feeding the electricity back into the grid, and we get a credit on our electric bills instead of a higher rate. That's coming down the pike. We need a digital grid. We need even more incentives to do these things. And Congress really needs to get on the ball and say, look, this is the direction we should be going in. We can create jobs this way. We can lower the cost of home ownership. Everybody wins.
I want to thank the caller. We're getting short on time here. We have 3-4 minutes, and I have one more person that I would like to try to include, and they're in Champaign, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
I don't mean to interrupt the flow of the program, which has seemed to shift toward green building, but I'd like to go back a moment to the crisis and the causes for the crisis. You failed to mention that a lot of the people who were flim-flammed were the victims of outright fraud. In other words, their submissions were altered, their incomes were raised on their applications without their knowledge. Why aren't a whole bunch of people going to jail? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I think that is a question a lot of people have asked.
Well, yes, and I did get into this in later part of my book in terms of outright exploitation. I think a lot more people should be going to jail. There was a lot of fraud going on, and the FBI has a whole unit in Washington investigating this, and they have probably hundreds of thousands of cases. There should be some major investigations, and I predict this will go on for years, and there will be people thrown in jail over this.
So you think it may take some time, but there will be accountability?
Not full accountability. I think a lot of people slipped through the noose, and this is the kind of deal that happened because it just blew through so quickly, and we're trying to fix the general economy, so this is going to get swept under the rug in a lot of places. But, you know, where we have the resources, and I noticed that the Obama administration dedicated a lot more money to investigate this, and, you know, there should be a lot more justice seen, I hope.
We're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. You know, one of the things that we really haven't talked very much about, but you certainly deal with in the book, is how the pattern of growth that we'd seen, particularly the movement out of city centers that we've seen, say, in the post-war era, has fostered a really not sustainable pattern of development that particularly makes people very heavily dependent on the personal transportation in the form of the automobile. And some people think that certainly, and there has been some interest in trying to redevelop the city and in having people move back to the city. Is that something, do you think, that actually can happen or will happen on a significant scale?
Oh, it already is happening. In fact, demographics is really driving this. As empty nesters and baby boomers get older, they don't need that 4- or 5-bedroom house in the suburbs. They want to be where the action is. They want to be near symphonies and other cultural amenities, things like that. So they are moving in the cities. In fact, Chicago's population had a little bit of an uptick in the most recent period, in most big cities that are established are going to benefit. But it's not just cities. It's inner suburbs with established town centers. It's old-fashioned towns that you see throughout the Midwest with, you know, the old town square. You got the library and the Masons Hall and the supermarket, I mean, all within walking distance. They are literally designing more towns like that. If you look at the model of the Amish, who have a great community just south of Champaign, I mean, they've been doing this for years. They are the model for sustainability, and they manage to do everything within a short radius of where they live. And this is a great idea. I mean, why do we have to be so dependent on transportation to get everywhere? I predict that a lot of the big boxes, the huge mega centers that they built on the edge of interstates and highways, are going to be empty. We're going to have to convert into the assisted living housing or something, because they're going to be empty, and because energy prices are going up. It's just a world economic reality.
We will have to stop there. We've come to the end of the time, but if you want to read more on this subject, you can look for the book that we've been talking about, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream, published by Bloomberg Press. Our guest, John Wasik, is personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News, author of a number of books. He makes his home in Chicago. You can look for the website, which is cul-de-sac-syndrome.com, find out more about him and about the book. And Mr. Wasik, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.